Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD. They're your number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from all over the world. If you head over to DiabolikDVD.com this week, you'll find some terrific new arrivals like Arrow's release of The Fifth Chord, an all-region Blu-ray edition of Dario Argento's The Card Player, a three-disc special edition of Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, and an all-region media book edition of Hammer, House of Horror. Also, you'll curiously find David Robert Mitchell's Under the Silver Lake, Region B?
Which I've been dying to see.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to pick that up, guys.
So, Blue Underground titles, Code Red titles, and so much more await. I perused the site this afternoon and loaded up my cart, so why don't you do the same? And again, head on over to DiabolikDVD.com today and tell them Shockwaves sent you.
This episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by 2019's edition of Texas Frightmare Weekend, which takes place May 3rd through 5th at the Hyatt Regency Dallas Fort Worth Airport Hotel. It's the convention's 14th year, and it will be presented by Arrow Video. Check out this lineup: Bruce Campbell, Tim Curry, Robert Englund, Lee Majors, Meatloaf, Joe Bob Briggs, and that is definitely not all. Halloween, Reanimator, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Rocky Horror Picture Show, and The Evil Dead will be celebrated with panels and other special guests. Hey guys, guess who else is going to be there? The Shockwaves team.
Yeah,
we'll be back. And for more details, head on over to TexasNightmareWeekend.com, and we will be giving you more details as we get them here on the show.
Okay, welcome to episode 129 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galluzzo. I'm sitting here with Mr. Eller Kane.
Hi, Rob.
How you feeling this week? Better?
I would say I'm no longer sick.
You got a hot tea here?
I got a hot tea. You know, I learned some things being
good,
sick.
Good. I'm keeping my distance regardless.
That's okay.
Also drinking tea, Ryan Turek.
Good night, sir.
All right. Good night.
I'm out.
This is a Christmas carol.
It's just the hot tea because it's cold out, right? It's cold and raining.
It's cold and raining, which means it's the apocalypse here in Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Also, Becca McHenry, also tea?
I have hot tea. I was sick all weekend, so I am having my hot tea now.
Sick all weekend, which means we have sultry Becca voice.
Yeah, it's a little gravelly, if you guys can't tell. Boy. I coughed a lot.
Guys, we used to have edge. We used to drink. Now it's like everyone's drinking hot tea.
Guys, I need my peppermint before bed.
Remember our 30s, guys? Remember when we were in our 30s a couple years ago, podcasting in
our
30s?
Shit was wild back then.
That was wild, yeah.
All over now. Mm-hmm. So, hi. Welcome back. It's the new year. We've kind of kicked it off already. Last week was Lynn Shea, which is great.
Yeah, the response to that episode has been very good. So
I went right home to watch Kingpin, which she completely steals. I think she's wonderful in that movie.
Did you see her Instagram this weekend? She was like posting photos somewhere where she was holding onto critters. There were critters.
Oh, I don't even know where that was.
I guess the Chiodas, maybe?
Maybe. I don't know. But they look like original critters.
She had also said that she was going to do something with her horse.
Yes.
So. No, yeah, the Chioda brothers do a crazy horse party every year. I love it. I missed it.
Critters are everywhere. Killer clowns.
Critters, they're on horses. It's crazy.
They have weapons. Fuck.
Killer clowns horse party.
Yeah. Well, so much to talk about. Let's see. I guess I'll kick it off. For the most part, have finished my deep dive into Christopher Lee Dracula because Warner Archive has put out Horror of Dracula on Blu-ray, which is the first one. And then Scream Factory did the second film, Dracula, Prince of Darkness. And so I watched them back to back. The only one I haven't rewatched yet is Scars of Dracula, which I don't think is available here. I have an import DVD of it, but I imagine it. You know, since the last show, Scream Factory's announced a number of other Hammer movies, including the really crazy Shaw Brothers one.
Oh yeah, that's Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires. I love
so
that.
So
that's actually one of my
great
favorites.
Movie. I love that movie.
So they're doing a Blu-ray of that.
I think you need a flowchart when you talk about these movies, because otherwise they all in your brain. When I hear you talking about it, it's like I can't think which one's which. I need literally examples.
It's just my lack of Hammer knowledge, because I'm sure, like, you know, if I started going off, or one of you guys started going off on slasher films that I wasn't familiar with, it they would all start. I can't tell my blood hook from, you know, everything else. So
Doom Asylum?
No, I can tell those apart.
Actually, that was a good reminder to see Bloodhook. I still haven't seen
I have not seen Bloodhook either, so I shouldn't diss it. But no, I mean, I think that is just my sheer lack of knowledge on Hammer films that I really need to brush up on. So I have all the Scream Factory ones sitting on my
desk. I've been kind of watching out of order because Warner Archive did the latter ones, like Dracula AD 1972.
Which I have seen that one.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
But these are the first two, and I think these are among the best. I think the original Horror of Dracula is the best Christopher Lee one because it's the first. It's kind of – and what I like about it is it retells the Dracula legend that we already know, but it kind of does it at a much brisker pace. You know, it's like you have your Van Helsing, Peter Cushing is great. But that's why I want to talk about both of these films together. So then you get to Dracula, Prince of Darkness, which I'd never seen before. And what's interesting about this is basically they take the Renfield character and make him kind of the main plot point of Prince of Darkness.
I remember that.
That's kind of like the one element they didn't do in the first movie they kind of expand upon and do in the second one. And also it's notable because it's basically this group that I can't remember the guy's name, but the Renfield type guy puts up a group of travelers, this couple. He doesn't appear until like 50 minutes in. Mm. Basically, they finally resurrect Dracula, and he's got no lines of dialogue. He didn't say a word. Now, what's interesting about it is I think in interviews, and they even talked about it in some of the special features, I think in interviews, Christopher Lee had said, oh, yes, the script to that one was so bad. They wanted me to say lines like this, this, and that. And I was like, no, I'm not going to say that. So that's why I don't talk in that movie, which the writer has discredited because he's like, actually, he did say those lines, and those are in a later Dracula movie. So I think he's confusing the one that I wrote with the one he did later that has terrible dialogue. He's like, no, I made it in the script. He made it a choice to have him not talk because you've met Dracula and they've killed him. Now he's something else. You bring him back and he literally is a undead creature. Mm. It's like, what is he going to say? He's just going to be scary. And he really is. And one of the most iconic images of him is kind of this on the cover, that they did. So I don't know. I really dug it. Now I've kind of seen them all out of order. Now I want to start, in a couple of months, I'll go chronologically. And that would include watching Brides of Dracula between these two, since that's technically the second movie. Mm. And the one that we just mentioned, the Seven
Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires.
That's considered the final one, because I think Peter Cushing's in that as that Van Helsing character as
well. Wait, what's the one you just – the Brides is actually, weirdly enough, one of my favorites just aesthetically.
That's the second.
Yeah, it's
that's
gorgeous.
That's technically a sequel to Horror of Dracula.
But it's not a Dracula story. He's not Dracula.
It's another, but it's the same Van Helsing from
So there's a through line.
Continuity wise, if you look it up on Wikipedia. Yeah.
Well, I wonder, cutting back to ye olden times when these films came out, do you think that horror nerd kids got super excited about each entry like we do today when it comes to like Saw movies or Final Destination movies or Friday the 13th?
Yeah, because I have interviewed so many people who describe like when I'm saying like what got you into the genre, they will say the Hammer films. And, it was their canon.
So do you think there were fan theories running about. They were like, oh my God, they're going to do Kung Fu for the next film. Lee's going to do Kung Fu?
What's interesting, there wasn't blogs and things like that, obviously, back then. But hearing Luca Guadagnino talk about Suspiria really brought that home for me when he started talking one of those interviews where he's like, I was like, 10, and I started like drawing my own posters for Suspiria with my name directed instead of and you realize like, so that obsession that people have as kids, they're, if it's not blogging or podcasting, they find some way to love the thing they love and obsess over it.
So, pen pals.
Yeah, or whatever. Yeah.
Hey guys, who wants to be a Shockwaves pen pal? Hit me up.
Should we create that?
The first letter to come to Blumhouse.
Yeah.
We actually get a lot of them through the email.
Our Shocker pals.
I answer that.
So these are great. The Horror of Dracula, Warner Archive doesn't really do special features. Mm-hmm. It's basically just the movie. And sometimes they'll include, trailer and subtitles.
Does that say $21.99?
Yeah, that's the average price for Warner Archive because basically the Warner Archive discs are burned on demand. Yeah. These are not mass produced. But they often have, I did a Warner Archive episode of Just a Disc with Brian, who is Elric's co-host on
Beers. They're both traitors.
Look, if it's something that you absolutely want, like this I got right away, The Thing from Another World I got right away.
Oh, so you have to buy direct from their website?
No, you can buy them on Amazon. But they're usually priced this initially, but fairly often they do a four for 11, where basically you can get four titles for $11 a piece, which is actually a great deal. And you could take advantage. They do it like every couple of months. And these weren't included in the last sale, so probably the next one they might be. But again, if it's something like this that you really want, like I just can't wait on certain titles. It's like, yeah, I'll pick up – like Leatherface was a day one buy from Warner Archive. But then the Scream Factory release of Prince of Darkness – so there's two versions, a UK version, a US version. They're two different – they did a new scan for the US version. I like that they do this, that people get so intense about the look of a film because there was an older Blu-ray, I think, in the UK from a couple years ago. So that's the UK scan. Mm-hmm. That one looks fine. It just looks a little brighter than it should and kind of has that what do they call it? That like digital – it almost like when they digitize it too much that it looks a little blurry. Mm-hmm. Like it doesn't – it loses the film grain to it.
Right.
So it's a fine version of it, but I actually much prefer the new scan that Scream Factory did, which is the US version of it, which does have that dark gothic tone to it and a lot of grain. And I don't know. When I'm watching an older movie, I just like the vibe. It fits the gothic vibe of the Hammer movies. So this is an excellent disc. There's tons of other features, but I haven't really made my way through everything yet.
Well, congrats on your journey.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. And I can't wait to go into it again. And now I'm going to watch a lot of the more obscure Hammer movies because I have an old UK box set that's got like 24 movies in it.
The Beast Must Die.
At least half
those
of them.
Those I've seen a lot of. I feel like I've seen She,
Plague of the Zombies.
Frankenstein, Created Woman. I've seen a lot of those. I just haven't seen many of the Dracula series.
Yeah, so I'm going to – I'm enjoying – again, we all have our blind spots and Hammer was a big one for me and I've enjoyed kind of opening this world up. So
you should check out – have you seen Rasputin the Mad Monk?
Oh, it's good. No, I like that one.
No, I haven't seen that one.
I would look it up.
It's
try
fun.
To find it somewhere.
And I haven't seen the really Quartermass movies either.
Oh, Quartermass movies are wonderful.
So good.
Okay, those are on my list.
My parents, they would always watch this when I was a kid, and I watched them with them.
All right, Elric.
Oh, are we still going? Here we go.
Show's not over yet.
I've prepared a list. Okay, well, let's start by talking about something that really bums me out because I was just on episode 4 of 6 of Channel Zero Dream Door, and it's easily so far the best of all of them so far. Even it's so, I don't know how it's going to end with the last two, but man, is this a great concept, great character, really interesting cast. I'm totally into it. And then I look at Twitter today and it says it's canceled.
Yep.
I would – maybe there's a chance it would end up somewhere else. Like I don't know how sci-fi plays the Netflix game in that way. But I think I want to just do a tribute to Nick and Costa because what I like about him, besides him just being a good guy, we've obviously met him a couple times on our show, but what I love about him as a producer is he kept finding talent in such unique ways that you don't really hear about that often in this industry. Obviously, Evan Katz, who did this one, is obviously a proven commodity, but so many times he took these total left field risks on people who hadn't even made a feature, which is what, I mean, the last person had only made a short that he had seen randomly, and I just think it's really interesting, and I think it showed because the shows are really interesting, and I think I still have an episode, two episodes left of the previous season for some reason, just like left hanging on my, so I have to go back and finish. But I really, as a overall work of art, these four seasons, you know, they're just so interesting, and they're just always taking risks, and they have non-TV aesthetics, you know, they're very cinematic and very surreal, and so I'm really bummed. I hope it ends up somewhere. I'll let you guys, I won't talk too much about it until I finish the series, but I am like literally Pretzel Jack. Like it was just like the same reaction I had to Terrified, where he first emerges. I had that same jump where you're like, "What the fuck is that thing?" And but this one's really earned emotionally. It's very much about somebody whose dreams were able to actually conjure something into the world, and it's really cool. It's shot really nicely.
What I like about Channel Zero it's daring and unafraid to, you know, kind of lurch into very weird territory. I finished No End House, and No End House has elements of cannibalism and a lot of nightmare logic and otherworldly stuff. That's and it's deeply emotional too. But I'm very, very eager to see catch up to you in this season.
Yeah, and then the last one is full-on cannibalism and has Rutger Hauer and stuff, and I was really getting into it, and I don't know where I just – you know, sometimes with TV, if you fall out, you fall out. But these two I'll definitely watch by next week.
See, I liked the last season, the one – it was Peaches Meat. I can't remember what the subtitle was, but it was the Peaches, and it had a lot of, like, socialism in it. There was definitely, like, the rich feeding off the poor allegories going on. There was a lot.
Yeah, it was definitely grosser because it was all meat and eating, and sometimes – that that can be a little tougher, whereas this one's very clean aesthetically and no end. And sometimes the six-episode format's interesting too because it'll feel like they have two or three that are completely just brilliant. Right. Mm-hmm. And then it's not that the others are bad. It's just that some of these stories, the amount of time you're having to spend, 6 hours, is kind of a long, weird lull in the middle a little bit. I felt with No End House in the middle, but it ended strong and started incredible. Yeah. I think the first two of that is like the first – I think the first episode that's my favorite of any of it, that first episode, I just remember being like, what is this? You know.
Well, I think what was interesting about where you were bumping on with No End House is that there is the point where, you know, they come back.
Mm-hmm.
And it's literally like episode four and you're like, okay, that is – we just completed one arc. Where else is there to go?
Yeah, and are they back or are we
still? Are they back or not, or is it the real girl that is back with him? Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of questions.
But I love it, and I really think he should be proud. Like, even if it doesn't come back, he should be super proud of all the risks they took and the voices they got launched, and this is damn good
TV. It should be noted that – you know, because Nick had said, I think, when he was on our show one of the times that you know, even though technically sci-fi is canceling it now, they did take a big risk and they committed to these four seasons all along.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it was a giant. Yeah.
So
it was
thing. It's not like, see how the first one goes. They trusted him enough to be like, you know what, we'll give you four seasons.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So the fact that he was able to do this much is actually kind of a gift. Yeah.
That's great.
You know? And yeah, I haven't seen this new one yet, but I do love what this show does. And I know
you'll like this one the most.
Is it just the first season that's on Shudder, or are there more?
I think they're all three.
All of them are on Shudder now? Okay, that's great.
And some of them are on Netflix as well, right?
Yeah.
They were. I don't know now.
They were. I'm pretty sure that some
of them. Oh, no. Shudder has the exclusive on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Shudder has the exclusive on Channel Zero.
So who knows? I hope, either way, I hope, you know, Nick gets to do some more cool stuff.
Yeah. I have no, he's not someone I'm like worried about. It's more because he's just talented. It's more just, I think this was a particularly unique TV offer. So super cool. Yeah. So I love that. Cool. Loving that, rather.
Loving that. I just randomly put on a show. Not a show, sorry. A movie called The Last Showing. Came out in 2014. You could find it on Shudder now. I'm sure you could find it on a couple other VOD networks. But this is directed by Phil Hawkins. It's a UK production. And basically it's Robert Englund playing a disgruntled projectionist who goes from projectionist at a multiplex and getting bumped down to slinging popcorn behind the counter, working with a bunch of youngins and not quite understanding who they are. And then he decides he's going to craft his own horror film one night, and he targets a young couple who are on a date seeing The Hills Have Eyes 2.
Dog flashback.
Yeah. Ah. Yeah, it's really funny listening to the girlfriend go, "Honey, we're going to go see Hills Have Eyes 2 tonight." And I'm like,
is this the original Hills Have Eyes 2 or the...
No, the original.
Okay.
Yeah,
Biker
the
Wes Craven. Hills Have Eyes
yes,
2.
Yes, yes.
Got it.
And so Robert Englund manipulates the evening and basically drugs the girlfriend, corners the boyfriend, and he basically sets into motion a bunch of things so it looks like the boyfriend has committed a murder. And meanwhile, Robert Englund is getting this all on security cameras and stuff like that. The nice thing I will say about this film is that they make
Eric's
the use
a lot.
They make the use of their of their location, because clearly they were able to use a legitimate multiplex, and looks like they had full run of it. They go up to the roof, they go into the projection booth, they're behind the scenes, they're able to break some glass, smash shit up. So that's going for it. I think it's enjoyable always watching Robert Englund play the villain, even if he is kind of teetering between a U.S. and a British accent.
He does that a lot.
Yeah.
Spencer Price used to do that all the time.
His was continental.
Yeah.
I had to text someone to go, "I don't know if he's doing a British accent." Yeah. And they're like, "No, it's confirmed." It wavers in and out. But there were some interesting ideas in here. But it springs from a... I mean, it was only 4 years ago, but it feels very like 2006. You know, it's like a little it tries to be like a little meta, because it's like, you know, pulling in, you know, horror references and stuff like that. But I don't know. I just hit play on this one day and I was like, all right, I'm just gonna watch this thing.
Yeah, but we did have a meta period back in 2006, because we had like the Midnight Movie. And there was a bunch of them that came like back to back.
Yeah, Midnight Movie would be a great double feature with this.
Yeah, like Leslie Vernon was right at that same time.
Yeah, let's look at how clever we can be by, you know, embracing the horror movie genre and trying to make our, you know, Robert Englund's trying to make his own horror movie. I will say the ending is a nice little kicker
kicker in the pants. Oh, yeah? It worked for me.
I like the tagline. It says, Robert Englund, he's got Final Cut. Which is perfect
that
for your description.
That is way to put your star in the tagline.
Yeah, which makes you wonder, did he have Final Cut?
That's pretty cool.
Anyways,
awesome.
Last showing. Starring Robert Englund.
Cool.
So mine was one that I just happened upon as well, where I was flipping through one night and I found Sleep No More, which just came out this year from RLJ.
Mm.
And this is directed by Phil Guzman, produced by Jeffrey Raddick, mm-hmm. Which when I saw Jeffrey's name on it, that's why I was like, okay, cool. This just came out this year, which makes sense because 2 years ago, I remember a whole bunch of companies were like clamoring to get sleep experiment movies, which is the concept of this. And I remember getting calls from a couple of different places, like, we're looking for a sleep experiment. And it was because this, and Rob, you remember covering it on the website, I'm sure. This meme was kind of circulating, and there was a creepypasta about the Russian sleep experiment, where people would stay up for so long that they would like mutate and go nuts and kill each other and eat their own eyeballs or whatever. And so, because this kind of creepypasta had exploded, there were all of these different companies looking for sleep experiments. And apparently, this film actually got made. And it stars Bria.
Grant. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's set in the 80s, so she has really big hair, which is fun, and giant glasses as
it's
well.
It's her favorite nerdy role.
Yeah, she plays the nerd in it. Through the whole thing, she plays a psychology student, and so she's always there to describe any type of psychological disorder that's going on. So the whole concept of it is that a group of students, like grad students who are working with this particular doctor, are doing sleep experiments. But I like this one because it goes a little bit farther than just, you know, we're going to keep you guys up for 5 days and see if you kill each other and eat your own eyeballs. It goes much more into that they have this drug that they're testing called Cognifan, something like that.
Yeah.
And it won't let you sleep. But after you're on the Cognifan for a couple of days, you stop wanting to sleep. Like it cures you of sleep, they say in the movie. And what they discover is that the longer you are on it, that you start seeing things. And at first they think that it's hallucination, but they then realize that it's kind of, I'll say, opening another dimension. We'll kind of cover it without giving anything away. Like, you start seeing things that really exist. And it's just something that you can't normally see. It definitely smaller budget, and there are a few moments where you can kind of feel that. There's a couple of the digital effects that I was kind of like, oof, that one was not so hot. But I really liked where this went, and I had fun with it. It definitely had kind of a Stuart Gordon-y feel at moments as well. So, yeah, I thought it was
fun. So it sounds like the creepypasta Russian sleep experiment thing that so many people have been trying to crack here in Hollywood.
Exactly. See, that's the one I'm talking about, where two years ago. I got all the – like, I remember 6 months stretch where whenever I went to an office and was like, so what are you guys looking for? So we're looking for a Russian sleep experiment movie.
This one,
it doesn't mention the Russian sleep experiment. It doesn't tap into it in any way. It's just a sleep experiment movie. Group of kids shoved in a dorm, shot up with this drug, forced to stay awake, start seeing shit. But there's some interesting stuff in here. So it's not giant budget, but I did find it pretty interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I saw this a while ago as 200 hours.
Oh,
that
nice.
That was the original.
Yeah, that's how long they have to stay awake.
Hours long.
That's how long they have to stay awake to complete the test study is 200 hours.
Yeah, and I dug it a lot.
Yeah. It's
called Sleep No More.
But isn't that the title of like one of those haunts?
It's the title of the documentary of – there's a documentary called Sleep No More as well. It's the one, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, the Elm Street.
Never Sleep Again.
Never Sleep. Okay, thank you. Yeah. Never Sleep Again.
Sleep No More.
Cool. Is that the one where Freddy's a projectionist?
the last movie.
This has a crazy soundtrack. Like, honestly.
The score's great.
I want the score to be released because as soon as it started, I was like, is that Duran Duran? And then it was just all of these amazing 80s hits that I wish
How
I had all in
that?
One place. I have no
That's
idea.
That's why
great.
They couldn't afford digital effects. It's like they spent it all on the music. That seems strange.
Yeah, I had questions about that because, like, Hungry Like the Wolf is played in excess. And there was a couple other like major 80s songs that I was like, this is a damn fine score.
That is expensive. So. Okay. Interesting.
All right. That was Sleep No More. Let's see. I'm going to go back to a Shockwaves favorite because I haven't seen it for many, many years. It's from Vinegar Syndrome because only they would put out this kind of title. Elric had a wonderful cafe called the Jump Cut Cafe, and Mike Williamson would blow our minds with 16 millimeter prints.
Oh, I know you're
And he showed us a little movie called Disconnected.
Oh, yes.
That was one of the strangest screenings we ever had.
It was one of the strangest screenings ever. Yeah. I wondered if it would hold up on home viewing because...
Whatever that means.
The lunatics... Up, yes. Well, because I think you have that moment where you're in a room with other people and you're experiencing something that feels like... Aliens.
It's like a lost movie.
There's a communal what the fuck happened with that movie.
Aliens watched human behavior in the 80s for a little bit and were like, I think we can replicate this as a slasher movie. But anyway, so Disconnected, put out on Blu-ray by Vinegar Syndrome. And I still kind of love this movie. First of all, it's ridiculous how amazing it looks. Like, again, they did like a ridiculous like 2K scan of the 16 millimeter. The director does an introduction, and even he does like it's kind of like, hey, you're about to watch Disconnected, so I don't know, have fun, I guess. It's like it's not exactly like that, but it's basically almost dismissive of like, I don't know why you want to watch this, but have fun with it. And basically, what I love about it is there's like. There's almost like it's almost like two movies, even though it is a 90-minute running time. So the first is hold on a second, let me bring this up. It's from 1984, and the first one is about a girl who works at a video store, and who's not getting along with her boyfriend, and she's played by Frances Raines, who is Claude Raines.
Oh, did not know that part of this.
Yeah, there's some weird connection to Claude Raines. Ooh. I think it's his granddaughter or something like that. But anyway, she plays that character and simultaneously...
Wait, she's on Mutilator too?
Yes, she's also in Mutilator.
Hot damn.
These are her big movies, is Disconnected and Mutilator. So she plays the video store clerk and she also plays her twin sister, if you remember correctly, who's constantly trying to steal her boyfriends and stuff like that. Yeah. It's kind of crazy. And then there's the awkward guy who keeps coming into the video store that happens to be a serial killer. Who always says, "What is it? See you, bye."
Oh, that's right. That was the catch line. See
his
you, bye.
Exit. Like, I mean, he says it every single time, and it's just it became one of those. It became our hashtag after that. Just see you, bye. and so this whole thing where she's like, and even their dates are kind of like awkward in the way that it's shot, and the camera will pan from left to right while they're having a conversation in the car for no other reason than I guess it looks cool. But then it's like. So I don't want to spoil it because basically there's a conclusion to the serial killer story like at the hour mark and you're like, oh, I guess the movie's over. But then we follow the girl because at the very opening, an old man came into her house.
That's literally all I can remember. Yeah, it's a video store and an old man walking downstairs. That's
the old man walks into the house and disappears and then she starts getting obscene phone calls or like noisy phone calls.
Well, that part was pretty good, I
remember. That's the disconnected
part. That's kind of scary part. That was interesting.
And so that comes back in the last 30 minutes.
Okay.
So is the song still in there? Because that was – okay, because they
It's not a popular song. It's
Ecstasy's Complicated Situation. I can't even remember the name. I remember it was an Ecstasy song because I remember thinking like that's a pretty major song for this tiny little movie.
Yeah, there's one – I think there's a giant club scene at the beginning where there's some – I'm looking at photos now on IMDb. Yeah, there's a big club scene at the beginning where it's – I don't know if it's Ecstasy. Oh, yeah, and then there's also this stuff. There's the video store stuff, which is amazing. And then there's this cop because basically they keep cutting the footage of after the serial killer story. And he's like telling like, oh, man, it was just like a terrible scene. Let me tell you, I've never seen anything like it. It's like, what is this? What
sounds like a very weird movie.
Yeah, it's
one of the stranger movies we've ever seen.
Yeah,
this is a disconnected conversation.
Complicated game, which I want to know how they got the rights for that, considering how tiny the movie is, because that actually was a decent song.
Well, didn't he? I thought the director went on to do some music documentaries or something like that.
Yeah,
I guess I should watch his interview.
I remember the Q&A. Or the intro by Mike was that this guy didn't want this movie to ever come out because he was now in some other field. Mm-hmm. But then I think that's been proven wrong.
It was proven wrong because he did Psychos in Love, which was released.
Okay.
And basically when Vinegar Syndrome did Psychos in Love, they're like, hey, can we do Disconnected? And he's like, really? Why?
Yeah.
And like, no, we really want to. He's like, sure, whatever.
I think maybe I'd heard he had gone on to religious stuff and that's clearly not the case. Maybe that's the case with that. What was that one said in with John Hawkes? Set in the funhouse kind of thing.
It's either called Scream or Scary Movie.
It's called Scary Movie.
Scary Movie.
That's the one I think where that director went on to become religious videos.
And that was another oddball.
Yeah, that's another lost
movie. Ryan, you've never seen Disconnected?
I'm looking at this guy now. Never. He's definitely –
What are you worth, Ryan?
He's doing documentaries.
You've never seen Disconnected?
He is doing a lot – Lydia Loveless. Yeah, he's doing music documentaries now, guys.
Okay. What's the movie that Sierra loves so much, the shot on video one with like Tommy Wiseau?
It's called like The Ninth Door or The Seventh
Beyond the Door.
Beyond the Door.
Beyond the Door.
That's it.
I'll save you. You stay there. I'll save you.
I'm going to lend you Disconnected on Blu-ray, right, and I need you to sit down with her and watch it because it's somewhere between
that movie
and this. I think you'll both have a wonderful date night.
Yeah.
I'm just going to – Disconnected will bring you together.
All right, please. Yeah.
It's fun.
Let's do it before the wedding.
All right.
One film that I think is one of the best films of the year would have made my top 10 of last year if I'd seen it in time. It's called The Guilty. It is a Danish thriller, and it is it got quite a lot of press. I think it might even be the Danish inclusion for Oscars, and it's a cop who has done something bad. You don't know what it was, and he's kind of been told to be on phone reception duty for until his trial's up. And so the whole movie's shot in one room with him on the headset, and he gets a call early on from a woman who he thinks is I don't want to spoil anything, but basically she makes it clear that somebody has abducted her, but she's pretending to talk to her daughter instead of him, and he's getting the clues. And then he basically the whole thing just starts following him, trying to save her, but everyone kind of is pissy with him because of his past behavior, and they're not buying. And it is utterly thrilling. I was literally on the edge of my seat, and the reason I watched it was because Friedkin had talked about it on that Josh Larson podcast. He was talking about he's not that interested in recent movies, but he's like, but I saw The Guilty, and that thing's a fucking masterpiece. So the next night I watched it, and it's really one of the best movies last year, and it is really thrilling. It's not horror, but it's all like really intense. So that one I saw on Amazon Prime. I think you have to pay $5 or whatever,
but I
want to
see that.
Super fucking good. And then one that probably a lot of you have seen, but I've never seen that, the Blu-ray all these years. I finally watched Living Dead of Manchester Moore, Let's Sleep, and it's really
good, right?
Like especially the zombie, the eco horror stuff's bizarre. The way they like set up the zombies, that part's almost goofy, but the actual zombie attacks, are really kind of intense and frightening, and it's got the biggest asshole as the lead. The guy who picks up the girl, he's just a total
dick. Oh, he's a hipster dick.
Yeah, hipster dick. Yeah. But this is Jorge Grau. I've seen other films by him, and I don't know why. I think Let Sleeping Corpses Lie is probably a better title to explain the film.
Yeah.
Manchester Morgue, they're not actually in Manchester. Manchester is somewhere else where their bodies get sent in the story. But no, this if you're looking for like, this fits right into kind of a Romero's kind of zombie world.
Yeah.
And it's got some it does one thing that I really liked. The eyes of the zombies have these like red little skirt. It felt very modern in that way.
It
didn't feel like an old movie. Yeah. It felt like a really now movie, except for some of the fashions. Really a great zombie film. This would be like one of those like discoveries of the year for me. But I've been told for years that it's great. It's just one of those ones it took forever awesome. To.
I think I talked about this on Killer POV.
You probably did.
I'm just saying.
You know what? Honestly, what probably stopped me is I just, for some reason, I was like, a British zombie film. I don't know why, but it's not. It's a Spanish guy making a zombie film that's in England.
I discovered
just insult Britain?
Yeah, you know, besides Inside Number 9, what else is there?
Oh my God. Well, they did do Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah, besides that. Oh, you mean 28 Days Later? Okay, besides that, keep going. Wow. We could do this all night.
I discovered it because I think it was Anchor Bay that put out
a tin.
A tin. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Remember when they were putting out those tins?
Yep.
Yeah.
It came with a little toe tag, I think,
That's right. It was
but
great.
If you haven't seen it, and I'm pretty sure it is on Shudder. I know for a fact.
It's on Shudder, and I think Blue Underground did the Blu-ray.
Yeah, that's what
under
I
the title Living Dead of Manchester Morgue. Yeah. No, that's a great one.
Really good movie.
So I just feel like I'm bringing bad stuff to the table. So I swear that when we circle back around, I'll get to some TV that I'm watching and I'm very pleased with. But I do need to mention this because it popped up on Netflix over the weekend. Unbeknownst to me, I didn't know that it hit iTunes last October. I didn't see a single site mention this. But He's Out There with Yvonne Strahovski came out.
I like her.
And this was a film that was developed, I believe, over at Sony Screen Gems. Mm-hmm. Dennis Iliadis, who directed The Last House on the Left remake, directed it.
Which is a good movie.
However, it has arrived with no Screen Gems attachment, and it is now directed by Quinn Lasher. Lasher.
Oh, that's questionable.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me get into the movie a little bit. So tell me if you've heard this one before. A mother and her two daughters go out to a cabin in the woods for a weekend getaway. I forgot what the specifics are, but dad is lagging behind and he's going to meet up with them later on. She arrives on the property. They go out. This is like their vacation home. They go out every year. And things start to go awry when the two little girls follow some red yarn that they've discovered tied to a tree, and they follow it out into the woods and they see like a whole tea set. And when they arrive back at the house, one of the little girls starts to become very sick And Yvonne Strahovski was like, "Oh my God, what's wrong?" Well, you know, and the little girl's like, "We had like a little muffin at the tea set," and then she takes the muffin and she discovers there's this weird green jelly at the core of it. So someone's trying to poison these little girls. And when the little girl vomits, there's like a little note in her mouth and it says hello. So promising start.
I mean, fun.
even though like it's a very familiar setup, which is like Cabin in the Woods.
I'm still kind of in.
Okay. So, did I mention that it's got this weird Instagram filter over it? So it feels like it's incredibly desaturated. So it's almost to the point where it's kind of like a, it's trying to go for some seven-like achievement. Yeah, you're looking at the publicity stills, which have they haven't been color timed. So they have this very – it's got this very weird contrasty filler that only allows for very specific bright colors. So like a little girl's red dress, you know, tree leaves, whatever. So the movie, you know, when you get into it, it works in the quiet moments. There's some very beautiful shots of like the girls on the swings or Yvonne Strahovski just kind of like hanging out in bed, enjoying the country environment. But then things start to kind of, there's some really questionable choices where you got your lead actress who comes in and she takes off her shirt and the camera just lingers, and then she takes off her bra and the camera continues to linger, and it's like this really weird male gaze thing happening for no specific reason whatsoever. And she's
not like she's being watched or anything.
Not being watched, nothing happening. And then she walks to the, and then she puts on her shirt and she walks to the window and then she sees something outside. And you're like, why did I just linger on that for a while?
Could it have been that because the killer's
watching? No, killer's not there. Killer's not there. So anyways, what happens is, as the paranoia starts to build and they start to suspect somebody's out there, the husband arrives, the husband gets killed. It's not a spoiler. It's not a big deal. You're not going to die because of this. And then a killer presents himself and he's like a masked serial killer. And I was like, oh shit, this is totally my bag. But then it just goes through, it just goes through the motions of shit we've seen before over and over and over. And it becomes like a chase around the cabin, a chase through the cabin. You know, the killer himself, he's got kind of a good look. It's obviously like a Halloween mask or something he found.
Yeah.
And I will say that there is one great kill in it and one decent surprise. But these two things do not make a great film full of really bad stylistic choices and editing choices. And if you're, you know, if you're triggered by child endangerment, then you might want to just avoid the last act. But
does the twist reveal why she was topless? Suddenly a flashback to that scene.
No, but there
Simple
is a
Danning style.
There is a kind of a painful ADR moment at the very end where the killer, like, you know, has to divulge something. And you're like, I wonder how many iterations they went through this scene to just like explain what's going on.
How did he talk through the mask?
Kind of like this.
Okay, because I'm looking at this mask and it doesn't have a mouth.
Becca. When I have an axe to your throat, you're not going to care.
I'd never heard of this one.
Anyways, I think I killed it. I killed my mic.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, there we go.
It couldn't handle your serial killer voice.
I know. Anyways, he's out there. I saw on Twitter there were a couple of people that were kind of giving this a pass. I mean, like, I've seen this formula so many times and done so much better. The Strangers in particular. I think The Strangers had a heavy influence on this in the way that the killer plays with his prey. But at this point, it's like it's coming to the party a little late.
Mm. It's weird though, because I'm curious now. Obviously, the director changed conveniently.
Quinn Lasher,
and then I'm on the IMDb here, and it says it was originally titled Scarecrow. The script was featured in the 2014 Bloodlist as one of the year's unproduced most liked dark screenplays.
Wow. Yeah.
So I that wonder explains what the mask,
the scarecrow. Yeah. It looks like a scarecrow mask. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
But so I don't know. I wonder what happened here.
I don't know. I don't know. To be honest, because I like Iliadis quite a bit. I liked Last House on the Left, and I thought Plus One was incredibly interesting.
That's cool.
I liked Plus One a lot.
Yeah, there was some really interesting ideas at play.
Yeah.
I like Yvonne Strahovski. I don't feel like she's gotten a fair shake at anything decent. Like, she's in The Predator, barely.
Barely.
Yvonne Strahovski's
the wife.
Yeah, oh, the wife. That's right.
Yeah,
Dexter's where she started out, right?
No,
Chuck before that. But she, yeah, but she was also in Dexter.
Right. Yeah, she was really good in Dexter.
But yeah. No, I, you know, I just felt like she pops up in movies here and there. I just, you know, think she should have.
She should be a lead.
She should be a lead. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. So, anyways.
All right.
He's
out there.
Next round, I'll talk about something positive.
All right. And you caught that on Netflix, right? Because I think I just added it on my queue there.
Yeah, it was on Netflix, yeah.
Cool. All right.
So I rewatched Bucket of Blood from 1959, which I think was on Amazon Prime. I'm pretty sure that's where I watched it.
Dick Miller?
Yes, Dick Miller.
Because I think it was his birthday. I think it was his 90th birthday just like a few days ago. So you might have timed it perfectly.
Whatever platform I watched it on, it popped up when I was looking through because I'm lazy at like scrolling through and looking for stuff. And it was like second title. And I was like, oh, I'll watch Bucket of Blood again. It's probably been 15 years since I've seen this one. And it was just wonderful to revisit it. I always forget kind of how spot on they are with the language in it, their commentary on the art world and even just the delivery of the art people themselves, the arty beatniks, kind of the things that they say about art. Like it all just rang completely true today as much as it did back in 1959 with the beatniks. And then once I started researching it, they shot this in 5 days. And some of it you can feel. Like there are times that I was looking at it and I was like, I can see the seams of your sets, sir. Mm. But there are other times that I was like, man, that's a really good shot. You must have been really rushed to get that. That's well done. But I always have a good time with this one.
Is that Corman directed?
Corman directed
it. Okay, so this is early.
It was written by Charles Griffith. Mm-hmm. Did 3 films with Corman. He did Bucket of Blood, and then he did The Little Shop of Horrors with Jack Nicholson, and then he did Mysterious Wax something. It was one of the Wax movies.
And that movie was 2 days, right? I think.
2 days?
I think Little Shop is a 2-day film.
That's fucking nuts.
Yeah, I think that was the whole thing. They had
the cusp
set.
They had
literally 2 days. And I'm just like, that is so wild.
That's so wild.
To imagine
I mean, now I'm like, you want me to shoot in 11 days?
Yeah.
That's rough, guys.
Yeah, it really
but
makes me laugh,
two
that
days.
Idea.
That's crazy. And this one, you can feel how they do it because it's a lot of one shots.
Yeah.
So, like, they will literally get entire scenes in one shot. But it's dynamic enough that you don't notice it all the time. There are times that I was like, I really feel like we should have had an edit by now, guys, but a lot of it you don't even pay attention to. The whole setup for people who have not seen it is this kind of hapless guy played by Dick Miller by the name of Walter Paisley. Wants so badly to
which
be,
that name has come back in every
it comes
movie
back everywhere
ever by
yeah.
Corman, yeah.
He is just completely pathetic, and all he wants is to be in kind of the art circle with all of these really arty beatniks, hipster cats from the late 50s. And he can't figure out how to do it, and all of his art really sucks, and the girl that he wants is only attracted to artists. And then one night, he accidentally kills his neighbor's cat and decides to cover it in plaster, and everyone goes nuts and thinks that it's the greatest sculpture ever. And it kind of vaults his art career, but then he realizes he has to keep upping his game, so he accidentally kills his neighbor and then coats her in plaster, and it just keeps going from there. And so it's a horror comedy, it's in the 1950s, so there is no actual bucket of blood anywhere in there. But it's just a really smart commentary on the art scene and still is very applicable today. Mm. They remade it in 1995. I was not into the remake, but I really feel
same
like
title?
This is.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
I really feel like this could be remade today, and it could be really smart.
I
could.
And that one we watched at Etheria, where about making blood
feels
art.
Like
it's
great.
It's a short. It's a really good short, but it's funny because it's kind of drawing from the same thing, but in a very serious. But it's still making commentary on the art world. It's using real blood to create artwork, and it's interesting. Yeah, I think that the lifeblood as art and all that thing. Yeah, it's fun. But I always thought Dick Miller's super fun in that film, and it's very jazzy.
Yeah. There was also a theater version of this that came out, and it did like a very short run, I think, in Chicago, but I would have loved to have seen it.
Cool.
I think it's definitely time for a remake of this one.
Wow. All right, Bucket of Blood. I got one more really quick, and it's not really horror, but it's worth mentioning because today, while we're recording, it is John Carpenter's birthday.
Yay.
So, you know, 2 days ago, happy birthday, John.
Yeah.
I got from Scream Factory, they put out Starman on Blu-ray.
Yeah, good man.
I have not seen this movie in a really long time. I just don't know if it's because I'm getting older, how sensitive I am to the movie-going experience. I've always had John Carpenter favorites. I'd always cite either The Thing or, Halloween is my favorite. I watched this literally on New Year's Day. It was my first movie of the year, Starman, this brand new Blu-ray, and cried my eyes out. This is his best movie, saying it. In general, just in terms of a movie, it's like the best thing he's ever made. There's just so much heart to it. There's warmth to it. Jeff Bridges is freaking amazing.
Mm-hmm. See, the last time I saw it, I thought Bridges was really good in it when I did it for the that thing
for
Pearson.
Yeah,
but it's Karen Allen.
Terrific.
I think it's the best performance he's gotten in any movie by anyone, by her in that, because she is the heart of the film. She's the thing that makes him relatable. He's playing, you know, he's kind of goofy out there, but he does a great job. But she is so good. And in that last scene is one of the most beautiful things he's ever filmed.
Oh, yeah.
The last
sequence. It really is.
She's fantastic. This is the movie I really started to appreciate when she
had. What? I had a conversation with somebody about this right after I watched Starman, and it's like, you know, because I also had revisited Scrooged over Christmas break, and it's like, we don't have an actress like Karen Allen anymore. Mm. Like, that just immediately from the moment she's on screen just exudes this kind of warmth that you just immediately kind of fall in love with her, or at least are along for the ride. But yeah, I really think that this was – I think it's Carpenter's best movie, man, just through and through in terms of emotion and all that. And it's interesting.
Well, he also didn't try these things in many other movies. So it's a little loaded because, like, it's not like he's trying to go for that in the thing.
Well,
you know? So
here's a funny thing, and it connects. So the new Fangoria came out, issue number 2, and there's a wonderful article that I don't want to spoil. You really need to read it for yourself, called John Carpenter's Firestarter.
Yeah, that's
and
great.
And it's much like the Texas Chainsaw sequel article from issue 1. This one really delves into the script that John was going to direct of Stephen King's Firestarter. Yeah. And really, his was grounded. His whole idea was to ground it as a road trip movie between a father and a daughter.
Oh, nice.
And the thing came out, and he was they cut the budget. And basically, it was their way of firing him. And then the next movie was Starman, which is a road movie between a love, you know, well, a woman and a guy that – an alien that looks like
a dead lover.
Yeah. And look, this is great. There's a new documentary slash – Jeff Bridges is on the disc, John Carpenter and Sandy Carpenter as well.
Oh, shit.
Nice.
All three of them are on there for
in the same room or not?
No. It's obviously – it's edited together. Yeah.
I would love to hear Jeff and him just laughing like he does with Kirk all the time.
Yeah. But no, it was really interesting, and them just talking about – you know, because Jeff Bridges was still – I don't know exactly what he had done at that point. He'd done a lot of movies, but it was just interesting hearing – Carpenter talk about working with that kind of actor and how seriously he took it and the kind of ideas. I mean, a perfect example is, I think he said his the way he approached it was like twofold. One, it's like when you're a 5-year-old kid learning about things for the first time, obviously. And also his movements were very bird-like.
Yes.
He's like, birds are very kind of quirky and like looking around fast and all. And then you pick that all up. But then Carpenter's like, the thing that impressed me the most is that he – so there's home video footage that he watches of the real – because basically Jeff Bridges is an alien that takes the form of Karen Allen's dead husband.
Yeah.
And so in the opening, he watches footage of him, of the guy.
Home movies, yeah.
And he said – like Carpenter is saying he was so impressed that basically in that footage, he did stuff way in advance to know that he would be able to copy it like later. This whole like – yeah, it was really – when he pointed it out, I was like, oh, that is pretty incredible. Like that he knew he was going to be – like the type of faces he made were what he was going to use later on as that character. But this blew me away. I'm so happy that Scream Factory's put out like almost all of Carpenter's output. But like Starman is – if you haven't seen it in a while, it's just – I really just think it's his best movie.
It's probably one of the only ones that ever got an Oscar nomination for anything for Carpenter, right? Because that was for best lead actor for
Bridges.
For Bridges, which is pretty cool. Yeah, now that movie is really cool. It's weird to think he's the dude. Like it's so hard to – the dude man. Like you're like all these years later.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Starman.
Starman's badass. I'll just throw – you know what? I haven't rewatched this since Game of Funny Games remake was on TV, and it's not something you really want to rewatch.
I'm
not even
going to
spend long
on
it, but I will say it was better than it was like 5 minutes in, and I just couldn't stop watching for some reason because everyone's really good in it. It's just a painful movie. It's not as entertaining as the original had just this little bit of humor and this dark humor to it. This one is humorless, and yet there's something about Michael Pitt, and I just couldn't – it was like weird. I couldn't turn it off, and by the end, I was like
– Brady Corbett.
Brady Corbett has become a really great director in his own right. And
so good. I really love the remake.
You know, I thought it was a really interesting movie, and I was surprised I couldn't turn it off because usually I have too much to watch, and I watched the whole thing, and I thought it was interesting. I don't have too much to add to that.
I was actually at a preview screening with Michael Haneke in the Independence, which was really interesting because he came out, and he actually took feedback from my rogue journalist ass who snuck into it, and I was just like, that was marvelous.
Can you get him on the show?
No.
What was weird is that is
10 years ago.
I know. Work on
that's like the closest make remake I've ever seen. Like, it's more accurate than Van Sant was copying a movie. It just felt like exactly the same movie, minus just something in the tone.
But the same director.
Like, no, I know, but he didn't even change a word. I don't think. And I was like, that's a weird choice.
Well, they also got the blueprints of the house, the original house, and I think they rebuilt the house
down to the square footage and all this stuff.
Yeah.
But I think what it lost is, like, because the original came out at a time where it was satirizing something that it really landed. I think this came out after things like Saw and Hostel, and so maybe it missed its mark. But, but in terms of technique, I thought it was really well done.
Right. Yeah. So if you guys haven't tuned into True Detective on HBO,
it's wonderful.
The third season is off to a great start.
Were either of them by Sonia or not yet?
Was it?
Jeremy Sonia.
He's the director in the first. Okay, cool. Yeah. I didn't catch if he was the director of the first, the second one, but the first one, absolutely. And it's got me hooked. I mean, like, there's not much more you need. You got Stephen Dorff. But it's led by
Stephen Dorff doing Dennis Quaid or something. That's why I keep hearing people saying Dennis Quaid.
Mahershala Ali, who is
on fire, basically.
No. Oh my god! Because he's playing a young version of himself, and then a couple years later, and then an older version of himself, much older. And he's just fantastic in it. And so I'm very curious to see where it goes. Deals with a little boy and a little girl going missing. I'll leave it at that, but it's mesmerizing so far. And then I tuned in last night, and I'll reserve all my thoughts on this until next week, but I started watching You on Netflix.
I haven't dug into it yet.
And it is fascinating.
I've heard
because
that it's really
from
good.
The point of view of basically a stalker who works at a bookstore, and he immediately gravitates to a potential customer. And I kind of tuned out because I was so exhausted last night. But basically, he was like creeping on her at her apartment, watching from across the street as she's like at home. She's got no shades apparently, but she's at home and he's watching her do her thing. And then her kind of fling shows up, and it's played by Lou Taylor Pucci.
Oh.
And then he's like, he's such a hipster douchebag. And then they start fucking. And then, meanwhile, the stalker's across the street, like, jerking off in the bushes.
Oh, my God.
And then he's, like, envisioning what he was doing with her. But you're inside his head, so it's, like, a lot of voiceover. But he's a charming motherfucker. And he's also a good-looking dude. So I'm very curious to see how this show navigates through you're in the head of a stalker.
Yeah.
And how am I supposed to, like, I want to hate this dude. I mean, I do hate this guy, but he's so charming. You're like, oh, man, I could see how someone could fall into your trap. So I'm very curious to see where it goes. I'm going to finish the rest of the episode tonight.
How many episodes?
I think there's like eight or six or eight or something like that. So anyways.
It's just so weird with Netflix that you don't hear anything about these shows. So it's like somebody has to tell you about it. I didn't know that existed.
This one's been getting a lot of word of mouth the last week because I've started hearing a lot of people talking about it.
I saw people posting about it on Twitter.
Yeah, very curious. It feels like a very dangerous show. You know, it's just like, especially in this Me Too movement and stuff like that. It's like, oh, we're gonna make one of these assholes the main protagonist. It's like Jesus Christ.
Well, mine is also a Netflix show, which I'm so amused by how I discover stuff on Netflix now, because it's like after you finish watching things, it'll pop up with your suggestions.
Yeah.
So after I finished watching episode 2 of Marie Kondo
I told you I learned how to roll my T-shirts. This weekend, did you spark joy? I'm not even kidding. I think I went through about 50. I got rid of probably about 20, and then I rolled them exactly like they roll them. That's probably all I'll ever do, but it did work. I thought it was good. This was a rolled shirt I'm going to wear.
I already keep my house incredibly minimalist. I live kind of a Spartan existence, but it did give me tips on how to clean out my garage. I'm into that. But as I was finishing watching episode 2, it pops up and it says, "You may like," and then it's this demon show called Diablero.
How weird.
And I was like, okay, I'm in. Thank you, Netflix, for your interesting
your weird algorithm.
That somehow knows that I like organization and demon shows. So I ended up, it had a hell of a trailer. I watched the trailer first and it had just a hell of a trailer. Diablero is what I'm talking about. And started watching it. It is like supernatural, like on a lot of speed. And I had fun with it. The biggest thing that kind of killed me is it's dubbed. and it's dubbed very poorly. And I could not, I kept thinking, like, is there a way to turn this off? I'd much rather have subtitles. And I could not find a way. So I've tolerated the first two episodes with this god-awful dubbing. Huh. So I'm hoping I can find it somewhere in Spanish. I would much rather read subtitles than have to go through this. And I was not the only one, because when I started reading the reviews of it on IMDb, every single one is like, this show is great. The dubbing is killing me. So I feel the same way. And the concept is that this father priest has kind of fallen from grace, and he is now battling the forces of evil, and he teams up with the Diablero, the demon hunter. And it kind of is like this ragtag group of people where one is kind of like a superhero, like a modern day superhero, where and then the other one is the demon hunter. And one of the girls can actually like she can take demons in to hold them. Like she literally will be possessed by the demon because she can control it. They fight. Like it's this whole underground world of demons. It's like a crazy freaking Mexican horror movie, but yeah, it's like supernaturally.
Does look
it's
like
weird because the trailer looks like it's in
the trailer Spanish, is in Spanish, which is why I was like in.
Check on your TV. I mean, on everyone's TV set different, but on mine, if you pause on Netflix, the thing that comes up on the pause actually shows audio subtitles, like for my TV.
Yeah.
Try to pause it and see if it'll give you the options. They may not offer it, but usually Netflix is pretty good about giving you everything.
Because like 2 years ago, there was a show that they did, which I highly recommend, which no one checked out, that I love, called 2%. Or it may have been 3%.
Yeah, 3%.
3%. And it was Portuguese. And I remember when I first started watching, there was a dub, and then I was able to click something and it gave it to me in subtitles. And it was wonderful. I highly recommend that show to everybody. But yeah, this one, I could not figure out how to turn off the subtitles or the dubbing.
They don't make it easy, but you should be able to in theory.
Yeah, this one, it's really visually rich. So I'm kind of excited to keep going. So, yeah, that's Diablero on Netflix.
How are they going to survive when they don't advertise anything? I just don't know.
Well, I mean, we're getting bombarded by so much content.
Just
it's
so just
impossible.
TV shows.
Like,
I'm like,
there
I
is so much I want to see right now that I can't even begin to – like, I just – while I was literally – you see, I wrote haunted question mark. So while I was researching Diablero – this afternoon, it comes up like, would you like to watch Haunted?
Oh, I did see
and it's
that
some
one
new
up,
TV
yeah.
show on Netflix that I've never even heard of that I was immediately like, I should write this down. What the hell is that? So now I have to go investigate that.
How are you going to have enough time to whittle with all this TV? I mean, I want to sit on my lawn and whittle and just, you know, watch wait for the whiskey to distill like a commercial.
Man.
That's what I want. Anyway.
I understand. All righty. Well, we're going to break for our guest. Hopefully you've been watching the Into the Dark series on Hulu, which is co-produced by Blumhouse, because they've been doing a movie a month, which is kind of insane. And so we have the director of the New Year's one called New Year, New You. And we'll be back after you hear our sponsors again.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD. They are your number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from all over the world. If you head over to DiabolikDVD.com this week, you'll find some terrific new arrivals like Arrow's release of The Fifth Chord, an all-region Blu-ray edition of Dario Argento's The Card Player, a three-disc special edition of Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, and an all-region media book edition of Hammer, House of Horror. Also, you'll curiously find David Robert Mitchell's Under the Silver Lake, Region B?
Which I've been dying to see.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to pick that up, guys.
So, Blue Underground titles, Code Red titles, and so much more await. I perused the site this afternoon and loaded up my cart, so why don't you do the same? And again, head on over to DiabolikDVD.com today and tell them Shockwave sent you.
This episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by 2019's edition of Texas Frightmare Weekend, which takes place May 3rd through 5th at the Hyatt Regency Dallas Fort Worth Airport Hotel. It's the convention's 14th year, and it will be presented by Arrow Video. Check out this lineup: Bruce Campbell, Tim Curry, Robert Englund, Lee Majors, Meatloaf, Joe Bob Briggs, and that is definitely not all. Halloween, Reanimator, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Rocky Horror Picture Show, and The Evil Dead will be celebrated with panels and other special guests. Hey guys, guess who else is going to be there? The Shockwaves team.
Yeah,
we'll be back. And for more details, head on over to TexasFrightmareWeekend.com, and we will be giving you more details as we get them here on the show.
Welcome back to the second segment of our episode. We have a terrific filmmaker on. We've spoken about her before when she directed a film called Always Shine.
You did? Yes.
Yes.
No way.
That would have been a long time ago, though.
And she's got a new...
decades.
Like, that was like years ago, guys.
She's got a new film out on Hulu now called New Year, New You. It's part of the Hulu Into the Dark series, which is a Blumhouse Television initiative where we're doing 12 films over the course of 12 months, which is insane. Why? what would you do to subject yourself to this? No, seriously, the film is fantastic. It debuted just before New Year's Eve. I think it was like December 28th. Yeah. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what it's about for the folks out there who have never seen it? Do you want to explain?
Do I want to explain? No, I just want to check if my mic's on. Why hide it?
Do you want to explain?
No. His mic was down.
No, but do you?
Oh, God. Put me on the spot like that.
That's how
well, I
feel.
I will tell you, I would like to hear your synopsis of it. But I loved the film, by the way.
Cool.
So congratulations.
Thanks.
And a big part of it is Ryan likes to say old man Turek. I'm going into old man Rob G mode.
Oh, God.
Where,
Sophia, get ready for old man Rob G.
I am at that age now where I – well, actually, you know what? This is a good tie-in. I just watched on Hulu Fire Fraud, and Netflix is doing.
Oh, I really want to see that.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I've been wanting to see that. It looks amazing.
The Hulu one is terrific.
Okay.
And the Netflix one debuts the day that this goes up. So I can't.
Is the Hulu one like a fictionalized version?
No, it's interviews with everybody.
It's like interviews?
Including the freaking guy himself who put that festival.
Does he like own up to it? Is he in jail?
I think so. I think he's in jail now, but he is – so this is all going to tie in.
I was going to say, welcome to the Concerts That Went Horribly Wrong podcast.
I think he's a completely sociopathic millennial.
And the sociopathic, we have tied it into Shockwaves. Well done.
Fame,
keep going.
Fame-obsessed.
Yeah. I like see the whole, connection.
Yeah. No, so I watched that, and I was like – how – and also it's like not to discredit – look, I'm sorry to the millennials listening. Yeah. If you're out there, it's not all of you, but – the fact that many people got duped into spending like everything to go to like an island in the Bahamas because they thought it would be Instagram worthy.
Yeah.
It's just like – it's just everything
was
about
that
story.
Was that the only reason? I mean,
well,
like
– I thought it was going to be a cool
– I thought it was going to be like a cool weekend.
It was
like,
– no. It was a big film. It was supposed to be like the Lollapalooza or the, you know, the Woodstock of this generation with like and all the – the way that they sold tickets, by the way, is because they paid all the influencers like the – and I don't even know who they are. The – one of the –
like the Paris Hilton of this generation.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of the Kardashians.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry. This is how
Kylie,
out of touch
Chloe?
I am.
Chloe? I don't know. I can't tell them
one
apart.
Of them. One
stay
of them
on,
is
stay
what?
Stay on target, Becca. Stay on target.
Anyways, the reason I say that is because it's interesting how in today – to telling unique stories in today's in a modern context about how social media and influence and the way that people can influence you affects us. And that's basically what this movie is about. Is it four best friends from high school, but one of them has gone on to attain this ridiculous level of success, specifically for being a pretty Instagram celebrity.
Yes, also because she does a lot of like self love and self care, health and wellness, which
kind of reminded me of Goop.
Exactly.
Okay.
Goop or like Moon Juice. Like I think Carly, the actress who plays that character, watched a ton of interviews with Amanda Chantal Bacon. And I'm like particularly interested in that strain of like social media celebrity who's all about like self-love but is just this perfect, so curated human being who like is telling all these people who don't have the time or the money to put like the effort – not even the effort, just the time or the money to like buy the stuff that you need to look like that and to live like that. And so people are just walking around feeling like shit for not loving themselves. But those people like they're loving themselves, but they're like loving themselves as a product.
It's true.
So.
I'm obsessed with Goop. I would never buy any of it. I'm like the most skeptical person ever, but I am just so amused by it.
I always crack up because I call them fitness tea girls that pop up in my feed because I mean, like the phone is a scary place. And if I'm like talking to my fiance about, oh, I really need a new pair of gym shorts, suddenly gym shorts pop up in my Instagram feed.
Oh, my God.
And I'm like,
yeah.
What
really
the hell?
Really messed up.
But every once in a while, I'll see like a guy and a gal standing there with like tea, and they're like, this is the best tea to take after working out. And I'm like, is that tea really good? Let me see. And then it's like endless tea. I don't know what it is about tea. But that's well, going into your your film. That's what I was like immediately thinking about. I was like, I wonder if she would sell tea at the gym.
Tonight's Shockwave, sponsored by tea. It was a thing in our first act as well.
But here's the other thing I want to mention, because you definitely should, if you have Hulu, you definitely need to check this movie out. But I also just watched previous film, and the parallels between kind of I don't know how to word it exactly, but wanting to attain basically a life that you don't currently have. Basically coveting a life that you don't have.
Especially between women.
Yes.
It's woman interplay. I mean, your first one, Green, too, is the same. It's always these female relationships and friendships and weird boundaries that are interesting to people like us who've never had one, a relationship quite like that.
I think that, I'm a woman, and I'm pretty covetous. I think it's like an issue I've had to work on a lot in my life, is just wanting things that other people have. So it's kind of me working out my own issues. But I think what's particularly interesting about women is that we've been taught not to be so physically aggressive and to subvert our impulses to be as like nasty. And so we've found ways of being very cutting in this subtextual way that I think is really interesting to watch on screen. Just there's so many – in both those movies, I think there's just like these scenes where there's so much subtext and there's these like little pinpricks of nastiness that build up in you and kind of drive you crazy without being totally explicit.
Now, is New Year, New You were there leftover themes from Always Shine that you wanted to explore more in this? Or how did the story come about?
I didn't come up with a story. Blumhouse showed me a script that was written by this guy, Adam Gaines. And that script had like the basic structure is still there of what he wrote. And it's, you know, it's pretty similar story-wise, but I kind of went in and
I figured you went in
it.
And put your fingerprints on it.
I was really interested. One thing that I was like kind of concerned about with this is that I don't know if it's that I'm like now in my 30s compared to what I was all those years ago when I made Always Shine. Or if it's just the moment with like Me Too and everything that's going on, I don't actually feel that women in my life are as competitive with each other as they used to be. So one thing that I was kind of worried about was making this feel catty or sort of out of place in this moment in time.
But you also have there's a major backstory that, so these aren't just four people being catty for catty's sake.
There's
a backstory
like a whole other
of
thing.
Abuse.
Yeah. And then I started talking to all these other women in other industries and just who are maybe even a little younger than me, like the age of the characters in this. And they were like, no, we're all still like so jealous of each other and so competitive. So for me, it was just like sharpening each character's point of view and not making it just about like, oh, I want to be on Instagram, and making them each have like a really clear desire in terms of like what they wanted to get, not just in terms of revenge, but like their point of view about social media, their point of view about celebrity or about what it means to be a woman in this society in this moment in time. And that's kind of, I wouldn't say that it was like a residual thing from Always Shine, but I am interested in just like how women relate to one another and how they, the different ways they cope and kind of crack in our society under this pressure.
And genre is such a good place to play with that.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Now, were you always a genre horror? And genre is a giant umbrella, so.
Well,
it could
if
be...
musicals count as genre, then.
Oh, honey, we're going to like hang out now. So that's my jam.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I grew up like very, very unhealthily obsessed with Judy Garland. But
so Easter Parade?
Yeah.
Like one of my favorite films.
So good. Meet Me in St. Louis was the first
one I saw.
Oh,
my God.
Can I get a photo of the two of you together? Because it's just too cute.
But actually what I really liked about Judy Garland was like her darkness, her alcoholism and her sadness. So it's kind of dark. But
Like that was the whole thing of Easter Parade, was it was like her return to film after she'd had like this crazy rehab and fallen off the face of the earth.
She's
and everything.
So good. And
isn't she in the one of the Stars Born?
Second, James Mason,
right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Good in that.
I remember him.
Deserved
being
an Oscar. Yeah. And Hollywood killed her. Anyway.
And there's not even a copy of the full film. There's like missing parts or something of that film. There's a whole like missing section that they lost. Like the studio, we just lost a bunch of the movie. Oops. Huh.
It's really
crazy.
Weird for the director's cut.
That. Yeah, and there's all stills in it now. It's so
weird.
Yeah,
it is weird. And then in terms of other genres, I get scared so easily. So it's not like actually that pleasurable for me to watch horror.
Yeah.
But my favorite, some of my favorite movies are, like The Shining is one of my favorite movies.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's the correct answer.
What was the first genre film you saw?
What was the first one I saw?
VHS? Ty West has a good segment there.
I don't think this is a horror movie, but I just remember being so freaked out by Lorenzo's Oil. I think that
I guarantee you it's not a horror film, but it is kind of freaky.
I
never come up on the show.
I have a very specific memory of like being in the basement of my friend Nina's house, and they had like leopard skin rugs and leather. It was like, you know, early 90s, and leather couches and this huge screen, yeah, and a little wet bar. And her dad told this really scary story of a ghost and a kid dying. And then we watched Lorenzo's Oil, and I had to leave.
Like, so in your brain, they were like linked together. The story of the scary.
So yeah, I think of that. I have no idea what that movie's about. I just think of that as a ghost movie.
Let's just go with it. It is. Yeah.
Then I got really into the X-Files.
Of course.
Yeah. And I also remember, like, for a very young birthday party, I had a slumber party, and we rented The Birds and The Fly, but we rented the wrong fly, the one with Jeff, the Cronenberg fly, and that was, like, too much for little kids to watch.
Oh, my God. You meant to do the Vincent Price.
The Vincent Price one.
Exactly, which is just, like, not so scary.
Yeah.
Well, also, the other one's, like, a sexy film. It's, like, lots of sex scenes.
It's really intense.
It's kind of crazy.
So, there's a decapitated penis in it.
So those are the first movies I have a memory of. And then later on, I remember seeing The Exorcist, which is a movie that's like still so scary to me. I can't even talk about the thing that possesses you.
Yeah.
And I'm like so scared of becoming possessed.
Wow.
So like movies really
scary.
I
think the challenge is you have to do a possession movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, there we go.
It's intense.
I would say, Alma Shine had little elements of that. It had like transfer. You were like a Persona fan or Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, Persona.
It felt like of that ilk with personality shifting. And
as I got older, I got really into like Persona is a great movie that I've watched a lot of times. Three Women.
Yeah, Three Women is so good. Yeah.
Those are movies that I like always keep referencing kind of no matter what movie I'm making. I'm just like, let's watch that.
And they are those like fringe genre pieces because they've got elements of like the tension of horror, but they're not horror films, but they're also not like traditional art house. They're all weird. Like Three Woman Images is like a strange film. So
Images is so weird.
Yeah, that's interesting. But now, who introduced? Because we were saying before we started that I remember you popping up in Joe Swanberg stuff back when I lived in Chicago. And when were you kind of getting exposed to the filmmaking side of it? Obviously, you're an actor as well.
Yeah.
How did that all come about?
Well, my husband Larry Levine is a director too, and he directed a movie that I acted in.
What was that one called?
Gabby on the Roof in July. Okay. And that's with like Amy Simetz and Lena Dunham and Kate Scheel. And
yep, I have seen that film actually. I have. That's so might funny. Even have been the one I was thinking.
Oh yeah, so that one, my husband Lawrence directed, and that was sort of my first exposure to like I guess you'd call it like the mumblecore scene or like whatever the Brooklyn indie filmmaking scene.
Yeah,
and
because there's like Brooklyn and Chicago,
yeah,
the two,
exactly.
And then they all ends up in Austin with South by Southwest or whatever.
And Kate and Amy Simetz were both shooting Silver Bullets, the Joe Swanberg movie, at the same time as that Gabby on the Roof in July was shooting. So we met Joe. I met Joe through them, and it was a really cool way to come up where like. I don't know if I had just gone like the traditional route of being like a weird normal actress who was like auditioning for whatever TV. Like I don't know if I would have realized how much I like directing, but because that way of making movies is so collaborative and you're like holding the boom when you're not acting in a scene and you're especially with Joe, you're like talking about the story because it's so improvisational. And so that was really fun, and I kind of, you know, I had acted in Gabby on the Roof in July, and I think I had acted in a couple other like little mumblecore movies, and then I was like, I want to try directing, and that's when I made my first movie Green,
which is genre-y. Like it definitely has a vibe. That was the thing I remember, but it didn't feel, it's not one of those films, like it's more in the European sense where it doesn't feel like it's the full story you're getting, but you got enough of it to feel tension and
it's
concern.
Just, there's just like scary music
and like dread. You get dread, you know.
Yeah, but it worked out really well. Actually, my husband and I were just talking about like how it was kind of luck. Like I thought I was going to make just like one of those mumblecore movies where people are just sitting around talking. And then I thought I just was like, no, it's missing something. And I think also because I had a wonderful cinematographer on that, this guy Nandan Rao, who shot it really artfully, that I realized that it didn't like – it needed something more to enhance the way he shot it, and also because like Kate is such an incredible actress and she was the lead of that, just like wanting to really enhance what was there. So I just discovered this music that I really liked, and I think it really, really helped create this tone.
Yeah.
That I think creating some sort of suspense or dread, just some uneasiness, allows you to explore human dynamics in a really interesting way without feeling melodramatic or boring the way like a straight drama or like dramedy might.
Yeah, I always recommend people Sun Don't Shine, which is Amy's. My friend Jay was the DP of that one.
Okay,
so
yeah.
That I love that. I love those movies that are kind of hard to classify, but there is dread. And dread is, to me, is enough to be horror. You know, if that's what you're, a lot of my favorite films are just like Don't Look Now. It's got horror beats, but it's also just a dread poem, right? So it's, interesting. So and then at any point did you go, oh, now I'm going to actually start watching horror films, exploring it, or do you still just can't get into?
No, I do watch them. Yeah. I just am so physically uncomfortable. It's so scary.
But VHS was obviously, I mean, that was a huge, we were just talking beforehand how that was where the mumblecore scene and the horror scene kind of merged and really changed a lot of people's career paths.
Yeah.
But what was that experience like? Because you're in one with Joe and Caitlin Scheel, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe we're not meant to say she's in it because it's kind of.
I think by now you can say.
Spoiler on VHS.
I think
four sequels in.
A couple of years, you can say.
Okay, cool.
That was another just like Ty West directed that one, and I knew they were all my friends, so it was really, really fun. It was just like a free, exciting, like creative trip to the Grand Canyon where I had never been. But it was another example of just like really collaborating and feeling something that part of the reason I kind of stopped focusing on acting and started focusing on directing was because I felt so in certain scenarios as an actor, I felt so much like a puppet and like that my input wasn't valued at all. And that wasn't the case with Ty. He was really fun to work with, which was cool.
Yeah. And that one goes bleak.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good bleak ending. Yeah.
That one has that. I haven't seen all of the VHSs. I've seen the first two. But
what was the last one? VHS
DVD?
I think there's a fourth one.
There's three.
Viral. Was three the last one?
Viral was the last one?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
There was four as well.
And diving a little bit into the origins of Always Shine, I wound up catching Always Shine when Shudder picked it up.
Oh, cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I missed it when Elric was talking it up and
being
so.
Married back in the day.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry.
You've got your finger
on the post. Mulholland Drive, I love movies about that. I always have. I think it's interesting. I think it's kind of – it always hits on like there's a little bit of that person in us and we're in them. Mm-hmm. And but the jealousies in that one that take over make it really interesting. And I can't remember who the actor – but one of them has gone on to
– Oh, Mackenzie?
Yeah, Mackenzie became
huge. I mean, they're both incredible. Then, but Mackenzie is working a lot now, which is exciting for me. That was like based on my real feelings of jealousy towards another woman who it was in my life and who I felt – beyond the career stuff, I felt embodied femininity in a way that was more palatable to men than I did. And I always, growing up, just felt that I was, like, too much, too big, too loud, too annoying, and that, like, the right kind of woman or the kind of woman that is successful in romance and successful in being a woman was, like, smaller and quieter and more deferential to the men around her. And particularly, again, as an actor, I found that there were certain circumstances where if I were to be more challenging than other women around me, like particularly like, do I really need to be naked for this? Or like, why are we? I didn't get a very positive response from the directors and I didn't get, asked back to work on their next movie and other people did. And so I started to, instead of getting mad at the situation, I would get mad at the other women who I felt were doing it the right way.
Right.
Simultaneously, like, really mad at myself, too, for not doing it the right way, but also, like, resenting them for playing the game.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was kind of happening in a really intense way right when I started thinking about making that movie. And then I, like, was expressing those feelings to my – he wasn't my husband at the time, but to my fiancé, my husband. And he was like, you know what's so funny? It's like, I feel that way towards you right now because Green had just come out and it like won an award at South by Southwest and he's also a director and he kind of had always had this idea of himself as like, I think, you know, his perfect, this is maybe embarrassing to say, but like, I think he was like, I'm going to be John Cassavetes, you're going to be Gina Rowlands. And like, that's going to be our relationship. And like, you're going to be the actress in my movies. And so like, this was challenging to him. And so he was feeling competitive towards me. And so he really related and identified to those feelings, and then was like, you know what, I think I – and he's also a really great script writer. So he was like, maybe I could, like, take a stab at writing this for you based on, like, your ideas and our conversations.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he wrote a really great script, which, like, at one point maybe he was going to direct and I was going to act in. But I felt – I really wanted to direct that. Like, I really felt like the way to purge those feelings from me was to, like, be in control of the story, like, telling that story. And so I decided not to act in it. And that's when Mackenzie and Caitlin came on. And it was really
both incredible,
really fun.
And this, by the way, this is on Shudder. If you haven't seen it, you should definitely check it out immediately. And I love so basically, it's two best. Are they still best friends, or
they're in that weird phase where like you're still best friends, but you both don't actually want to be friends anymore?
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's a really specific. I don't know if boys have that.
Maybe.
I don't know. Not on the same way. like when I watch that, because I have seen those relationships kind of portrayed, not quite like this, that intensity, but some, I often do watch those kind of things and go, I don't know if I ever had that feeling with guys.
Elric, I got to tell you, man, so I just don't want to be friends with you anymore.
They're so simple. So you just like sit around watching TV in room. I don't know.
Yeah.
Guys are really base, I think, but you know, maybe it's just me. I don't know.
Yeah.
What they do see seems, I always think male relationships seem almost overly simple, maybe. I don't know.
Oh, I completely disagree with that. Yeah.
How do you know?
I don't. This is just outsider's perspective. Yeah. Right? Like, yeah. I don't think it's ever that simple. Yeah. No.
There was a period where I couldn't do guy friends at all. Like, I just got sick and tired of guy friends.
Why? Because all you did was talk about sports?
I hate sports.
Yes.
That's why. There's your answer.
And no, it was a weird period because I was like transitioning from one state to another, but I just surrounded myself with like just a lot of girlfriends because I felt safer that way. There was nothing, no connection. It was just all friendship. And I was just like, you know what? I'm completely fine in this space. And then someone, you know, a guy friend would come along and be like, hey, let's grab a beer. I'm like, no, I'm good. I'm going to watch some Fulci movies tonight by myself.
I have a theory that – well, it's not a theory. I think that men are – uncomfortable with their own emotions and are afraid of being judged by other men for having feelings.
For sure.
And so I think probably if you're an emotional man, it's more comfortable to be friends with women because there's not that barrier.
Mm-hmm. All right, you're sensitive.
Well, I think all horror fans, I think just in general, in terms of cinephiles, I think horror fans are the most sensitive of
I would
lot.
Agree with that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, without a doubt, from the people we've met at conventions and stuff.
Yeah.
And Rob.
Once I turned 40, I cried everything. Now I just can't help it, and no shame at all.
Never forget
Starman. I mean Starman. Yeah, we were saying I watched Starman again, John Carpenter's movie, on January 1st when the new year kicked off, and I cried my eyes out. I haven't seen the movie in like 20 years.
Oh wow!
Now I think it's his best movie.
I'm gonna rewatch it.
You should.
It's good. Yeah.
It's wonderful.
It's really good. For you as a director, I mean, going from Green to Always Shine to New Year, I mean, how are you seeing growth? I mean, are there lessons that you're taking away from each experience?
Yeah, definitely. Well, yes. For Green, it was just like my husband and my roommate, so I didn't have to like actually communicate anything to them. They understood what I liked. They understood. We kind of developed the story all together.
Yeah.
And then for Always Shine, I was working with actors who I had never met before. And so the challenge for me was like making sure to articulate and get articulate what I wanted, and also like just getting them to trust me and trust that like whatever weird process I was doing was worth it for their own experience and also for the end result of the movie. And then on New Year, New You, the big learning thing was it was like a massively bigger crew than I had ever worked with before, and I was really nervous going into it as a young woman director with like not tons and tons of experience, especially with a big crew like that, figuring out how to get people to trust me and to respect me. And I had built up all this anxiety that people were going to undermine me and like not listen to me and all this stuff, but everyone was so chill and nice. So that was like a really, I think of everything, that might be the most exciting thing I learned on any of the movies, because I feel like now moving forward, I feel much more confident about my ability to direct on a bigger scale and sort of like own the fact that I am a director and like want to keep working on bigger and bigger movies.
And there's decidedly a little bit more action in the new,
that's true.
Yeah,
working on
stunts.
This was like more straight ahead horror slashery.
Yeah.
And you felt you just jumped in.
Yeah. I mean, yes. I did.
You also had time limitations.
It was so fast, yeah. There was a stunt. I mean, I guess I didn't exactly know. Like, there's a stunt coordinator on set, so I kind of was just like, he'll just tell me, like, what to do. Because I don't know. And, like, so if that wasn't exactly true. And that was a couple – there were a couple times where I had to, like, really rally and – there was – I got a lot of performance anxiety in the moments where, like, I had to go through the blocking of my idea for a fight while, like, every department head was just watching. And I was just like, I don't know yet. Like, go away. Let me figure this out and then come back. Yeah. But we didn't have time for that. So it was – I guess that was – I don't know, man.
There's a lot of – like, I mean, like, I respected it because it was like there's a lot of things to track. There's a lot of upstairs, downstairs, in this room, in this room. I was just like, holy crap.
Yeah, it was where everybody was at all moments and then who's kind of aligned with who because that shifted throughout the whole thing. Yeah, there was a lot to keep track of.
The emotional, like, who's aligned with who, I can track, no problem. Where people are, I think there's plenty of holes if you watch it.
Like. Do you guys shoot that locally?
Yeah, we shot it in in, like, Cary Grant's old house in Westwood.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Some history there.
Yeah, man. His ghost.
How do you personally feel? Like, I know what the movie is saying about celebrity and gurus and Instagram, but how do you personally deal with social media? Is it something you embrace, or have you gone off certain sites? Like, what's your relationship?
I'm totally off Facebook ever since I found out that they were brainwashing people. Mm-hmm. And I try not to go on – I mean, my big bone to pick with, like, Instagram or any of these sites is that – you end up thinking about your life as Instagrammable moments. You're not really – or I'm not really present. If I'm, like, in a period of time where I'm Instagramming a lot, I'm always looking at things in a kind of removed way of, like, how can I turn this into, like, a reflection of myself that's, like, turning myself into a product.
Yeah.
And I really don't like going through the world that way. Or, like, you know, I'd be like, oh, this is a funny tweet. I'm going to save it for later. Like, I don't like thinking about that because it's so future-oriented and so outwardly focused and not really about – my own personal experience or how I relate to myself. It's very ungrounding for me. I'm very addicted to, like, I go on Twitter all the time to read about the news, but, like, I try really hard not to, like, tweet on my own or, like, Instagram on my own because otherwise I get really obsessive.
Well, Instagram is also part of the Facebook family, isn't it?
I know, yeah. That's what my husband always tells me. Yeah. I'm, like, a hypocrite.
Because we're all, you know, we're in a visual medium, I tend to stick to Instagram more than anything, and I just kind of keep reminding myself that they're part of the Facebook family.
Also, less of our parents are on Instagram. That feels a little better. Yeah. Like, less of that family thing to me.
You can't – also, I don't think you can spread, like, fake news as easily on – yeah. Instagram.
But you're right about living in the moment and the memories, because it's like, you know, you look at when Instagram came online and we all started thinking about the value of grabbing that one moment and that one piece of memory. And I wonder how many, like, people actually not suffer from memory loss, but go, oh, wait, I forgot this whole thing happened. Like, I went through my feed, like, on 2018 and I was like, oh my gosh, that's right. We went to the Overlook Film Festival. Like, there are moments where you're saving it to technology, but it's not being retained up here.
But wouldn't that happen anyway if you're going to look back at pictures just in general? Because, like,
not
I
as
do
much.
That.
It's like, it's not that. It's not the instant gratification.
I wonder if it's the same, because when you're taking a picture, you're taking a picture for later.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're doing Instagram, you're like thinking about it. You're thinking about how other people are going to perceive it. It's not just for you. It's for other people. And the liking of it and the obsessive checking of the liking of it kind of, I think, takes you out.
I think you hit on it, like a photo that you're taking with a camera is you're saving it for you. I think that's a really defined experience versus giving it to other people. Because most of us don't give a shit. If we take a selfie, you're saying you're doing it not at all for you in a sense. You're showing other people. Yeah. And all that you get in return are likes. And that's like that Black Mirror episode with Ron Howard. Daughter, just that nailed that part of this conversation in a lot of ways. How are we doing it to PV? I mean, I'll never forget, like, somebody coming up to me, this was a couple years ago. We had been doing Killer PV and Jump Cut and stuff, and it was like, you know, I ran this place called Jump Cut in the Valley, and I remember someone coming up to me going, oh yeah, you know, on Instagram, oh, your life's so perfect. And I just remember being truly shocked that they didn't understand that all I'm giving you is a curated highlight version of the best moments. Do you want to know about the fights I have, about the money? Like, and it was eye-opening to me, somebody saying that out loud to me. And it really kind of made me just uneasy about almost not wanting to post things that are so good. Almost wanting to show behind the curtain more. Yeah,
it is true. Weird. Like, I think, I don't know, I don't have kids, but, like, I think a lot of moms, like, maybe compare themselves to other moms who post only, like, the great things about their kids, and then, like, their you know, my kid's having a tantrum and that kid looks so happy. And you, it just does, like, really mess up.
Do your head in, especially if you're at home all the time. Media. Yeah, and, like, if you were a stay-at-home parent or something, you could see how it could do your head in if you're comparing yourself to people. Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, there's pluses. I think there is some interesting insights to how you can see also the good side. If people post more truthfully, you can start to go, oh, we are all alike in these interesting ways, and we suffer in interesting ways. And
I get, like, really into the Instagram posts of, like, people with, like, not traditionally attractive bodies in, like, sexy ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
That's cool, but I don't know if the bent like.
Well, I never know. I never know what to believe with anything. I mean, because there's so many filters out there. I remember seeing one that Ciara had shown me, and she's like, "Dude, watch this!" And it was someone. It was a woman wearing no makeup, no nothing, and you know, and then all of a sudden, the Instagram in 60 seconds showed you what the filter could do.
Yeah.
And it was insane. Yeah. Her eyes got wider, her eyebrows came on point, and all those
how
other
has
things.
That Black Mirror not happened where our eyes can do the filters to how we want to see the world? So that could be that would be a fun one. We're probably close to
it.
Yeah, there you go. How about it, Charlie Booker?
Every day I get reminded of why I try to ease back on it. And then I wind up like succumbing to like little bursts of like tweeting, being like, oh, I got this to say, and it's just.
Well, what's that? What's that? I don't even know that lingo now, but what's the thing? Fear of missing out?
Oh, FOMO?
Yeah, FOMO. Like that. What? That is something I hadn't heard.
Elric.
Well, no, I hadn't heard that till recently, and then I remember going and going, that is the syndrome, right? That's what we all suffer from. Like,
people
even
at
a
the
day
Fry
out.
Festival.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that FOMO came up a lot. Now I know what it means.
Wow. Yeah.
FOMO. I was like, what the fuck is FOMO?
But it's true now. Like,
he's like, is that some sort of disease control?
Get it.
Government agency?
Well, because there wasn't all – like in the past, you would catch up with friends and maybe something would happen. But now if you were offline, let's say for a week, as some people go, I'm off Twitter, and then they come back a month later. It's like there is this weirdness that you've missed out on all this life and all this world.
Oh,
but you're not meant to know all
of
that.
It is true. I got rid of Instagram and all those things, and now I feel like people who I haven't seen for the same amount of time as before, I don't know what's going on with them. I feel their absence more. But I kind of like feeling their absence.
Huh. But that gives you more fodder to catch up and talk.
Yeah, it's really weird to see someone you haven't seen in 2 years and know everything that's happened to them.
Yeah.
And just be like, oh, how was that? You know, I saw that you did that.
But don't you think we also take for granted that everyone's already paying attention to us? So we like shorthand things and you go, well, you know, when I was doing this thing, it's like if somebody isn't following you, they don't know what the fuck you've been doing. And it's really, to me, that seems fucking unhealthy. I don't know what it's like, this idea that you take for granted that people have been following what you're up to. I just
totally.
Like that.
Yeah,
well,
I
it's
just
creepy.
Realized I did that. Like someone,
I know,
like,
I do it all the time with
like,
everyone.
Do you it's
creepy
like, you
when
don't
I think
know about
it.
New Year, New You.
No, but yeah, there's something, I don't know, something unsettling about it, but whatever.
Yeah.
But I also embrace it because, you know, too bad. It's hard to turn these things off in the long run. They're going to be with us. So it's trying to find how could you embrace it in a way that works for you, I think. But, you know.
Yeah.
Well, people
what
need
Becca
to.
Saying
sorry, sorry. No, I'm just – I have to force myself to use social media. So I don't –
Really? But you're so regular. You're like a regular
I
poster.
Set alarms on my clock.
Right.
I honestly, I do, especially when Rob and I used to work at Blumhouse.com.
I can confirm this having worked in a room with her regularly.
I set alarms on my clock so that it would remind me because they had actually talked to me. The parent company of the website was like, we need you to be really active on socials and not even just these. Like, you need to build up your own personal account. I literally had to set myself alarms to remind me to post on stuff. And I still do. I still have the alarm set to post. And so I will look at the first 5 tweets, and then if it's not anything riveting, I stop. I just can't do it, and I still have the alarms to make sure that I'm posting. So I'll abstain from the conversation.
But if you're a filmmaker or part of this industry,
you have to do it.
Yeah, it feels like
I don't think so.
I will.
No?
Really?
I mean, maybe you let the machine do it.
Yeah, that's why I keep doing it. I consider it a marketing tool.
Right. Maybe for someone, depends on who you are in the industry. Like, I don't think actors should have social media. Because, like, it's so much harder to lose yourself when they're playing a role if you know all about their dumb, like,
it totally kills the mystery.
But that said, I know a lot of actor friends that they go into a room for an audition, and one of the first things that gets looked at is not if they're talented, it's how many people are following
them. Yep.
I have encountered that as well.
That's why I do that, is I've walked into pitch meetings before where they'll all sit down and they'll go, well, you have a good following on Twitter. And I'm like, I do. But yeah, I've had that happen before. So I will always post and always keep doing it because it is a damn fine marketing
tool.
Some
companies force you. I remember early Relativity Media, they forced Hemsworth's brother, the younger one, who, I can't remember Chris Hemsworth, whoever the other Hemsworth, he wasn't on social media to get the role. They said, you had to actually join Twitter, and then he joined and got all these followers, and because that's going to be such a big part of their media campaign was going to be run because they're trying to save money in other ways. And you're like, oh, that's it's something I just hadn't thought about when I heard that, and I was like, oh, that's that's a strange thing, but it makes sense, you know. That's the cheapest way to do it now. So
it's also depressing.
It is, but it's interesting, and that's why we do like these movies that tackle it, because it's always like, okay, interesting, all these angles of what it could be and how it can be misused. I think the guru thing's fascinating. I think people becoming self-appointed, because I feel like everyone's so desperate to look to someone else for answers now.
See, I'm really amused with the immortalization of Instagram, that like someone, it's literally like immortalizing a life. In a sense. Yeah. And so I've always wanted to do something with that. I have no idea what. But I've always looked at it. It's like literally a shrine to somebody's life right there.
Well, speaking of, there's nothing – sorry to be depressing, but there is nothing weird or more depressing than when somebody in your Facebook feed has died, but then somebody posts – somebody has posted from their account after they've passed to make some comment about it. And there's something so out-of-body weird to even read that. It's, I mean, hopefully it's someone you don't know that well, but I've read – plenty of just even listeners or something, and you're just like, oh man, this whole thing is so obviously so important that the only way to communicate it to the world is from that person's account. It's just like,
well, yet again, there was another Black Mirror about that, where
about that.
A woman lost her, I think it was like the second season maybe, where a woman, the one, she's from the Captain America movies, she lost her husband. And basically she signs up for a thing that based on his Facebook data, she could talk to him digitally.
That's right.
Like it simulates, it like analyzes all of his posts and his life. And basically she could talk to him.
Dude, that's so trippy. Wow.
And then they're like, do you want to take the next step? And they're like, what's that? Basically they make like – they take a flesh mold and they make a human being out of it and put that program. You haven't seen this episode?
I have not.
Isn't that
seen
like
this
that
episode.
Movie Marjorie Prime? I didn't see that.
I wouldn't know either because I didn't see
that. Looked good. That actually looked good.
But no, there's a Black Mirror. It's pretty early on.
Yeah, no, I do. I mean, I definitely saw it.
That sounds sad.
It's terrifying. But
why'd you come here to bum us out?
the other thing about
this got really heavy.
I'm going to say one other thing that's like kind of dark. Like for me, just thinking like if you accidentally died before thinking about what your last tweet was going to be, like. Dead people's last tweets to me is just really
that's
intense.
A book
that
right
be
there.
Hashtag dead like people's last
final words. It's now dead people's last.
Well, tweets. I have seen billboards by the side of the road in like Georgia or South Carolina where it's like half a tweet or half a text, and then it said this was the last thing they typed before their car went off the road.
Oh, oh man,
dark.
That is dark. Holy shit!
So let's talk about musicals.
I thought you were going to be a fun guest.
Back to Judy Garland, guys.
I can talk about her for.
What was her last dying tweet?
Do you see a musical in your? Do you ever want to do a musical? Think you got it in you?
You know, I loved A Star Is Born so much. Yeah. If it was okay, I think I could do like a really sick Judy Garland biopic. But not in like a traditional musical way.
Right.
More in like a Cassavetes opening night style way.
Which is a ghost story.
With some singing. Yeah, exactly.
Kind of a ghost story.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I could do that.
Then do you, now that New Year is out into the world, I mean, like, are you exploring other genre opportunities or what do you? That is not a loaded question.
Why, yes, Ryan. Let's talk some more.
Yes, Ryan.
Just really curious.
Yeah, I am. I mean, I do think, I don't know, like, I don't want to say, like, especially for women's issues, but I do think that, like, it's a really fun genre that I don't think has had so many stories about women by women told yet.
Yeah.
And so I'm really excited to continue to think about, like, the things that I'm dealing with or the things that I'm thinking about or other women in my life are thinking about and how to tell them with a horror thriller bent.
Has there been anything from a female director in the genre space that you've appreciated recently or liked or discovered?
There's a few, but now I'm bad at this. Like Raw was a really
good one. Raw's so good.
I think Karin Kusama, The Invitation. I haven't seen Destroyer yet, but The Invitation was great.
Yeah.
I'm really bad at this.
Have you seen Blew My Mind?
No.
It's in the same family as Raw.
I really liked that one.
Yeah, it's about teenage transformation and there's some really interesting stuff in there.
Yeah, it's a little less.
It's not horror-y. It's not scary. It's not scary and it's not bloody, but I feel like it's there's a certain kinship to Raw. Mm-hmm. That's the
body transformation stuff. And,
cool. You know, the adolescence of it.
I'm not sure where that one's from, like not Denmark, but somewhere like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
I just wanted to ask about the most recent movie, because you have you've had a foot in acting and now you're directing. And I again, both Always Shine and this film have such strong performances. Like, what kind of director are you? Are you an actor's director? Like, how do you collaborate with your actors on things like this?
I think I'm definitely an actor's director. This actually was a little bit more challenging for me in terms of not just not having as much time to work with the actors as I was used to. Even on Always Shine, even though it was a really low budget, like, we lived in the space and we could just kind of take our time and do many, many takes. Mm-hmm. And this, the one thing that I didn't realize about the stunts was how much time it would eat up.
Yeah.
The
setups and all that.
Yeah, because I was just like, they say you only get one shot at it, so how much time could it really take? But that ended up taking so much time, and so I had less time than I would have liked to work with the actors on set. And then also just the casting process was really fast. Like, we were still casting some of those leads like the week of the shoot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was able to get a couple days with them to do what I call like backstory rehearsals, where they just kind of improvised what those characters would have been like in high school as friends. And I really wanted to make sure that the four characters had an emotional and physical familiarity when they got on set, so that it felt like they really did know each other. I really love working with actors. That's my favorite part of it for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I love having time to do stuff like that with actors. I think as I do keep wondering, like, as I keep working and maybe I'm working with more established actors who have a process that they've honed, and that probably they won't want to do that, or like they won't need to do that. And I'm interested in knowing, like, what is it to direct an actor who's like really established and really has their process, and how much kind of do you, I'm saying all this stuff, but I'm also really hands off too, where I'm just like, I'll do those backstory rehearsals and then be like, okay, do your job. Like, I picked you because you were right for the part, and so I don't need to actually tell you anything. And so, like, yes, it's interesting. In some ways, I think that'll be fine to work with someone maybe who doesn't want to deal with my weird, like, hippie acting. But then, like, what if I work with someone who's, like, really bad and I have to, like, figure out?
Yeah, I also can set the tone. I remember hearing about one of the things Sofia Coppola did that I thought was really cool for The Beguiled. But I think she does it for every movie. Instead of doing lots of rehearsals, she has one big dinner. And sometimes maybe it's like a whole weekend, but where everyone's just stays in their character the entire time. So Nicole Kidman in that film prepared a major dinner for every single character. Every person stayed in character for the dinner. It wasn't a table read. It wasn't anything. And it was just behavioral. And I was like, oh, that's really cool, because it's just like you're just in it. It's
that's
not like
really
let's practice.
Cool.
I might
steal that.
Yeah, no, it's really – I'd never heard of that before. And I thought, oh, that's good. And that's Nicole Kidman agreeing to that. So I think the best actors are probably going to be willing to be part of things if the person's good. You know?
Right, totally. So, yeah. I hope so. It's fun to do that stuff.
And what about on the casting side? Because one of the things I loved direction-wise in Always Shine is that you – mild spoiler, but not really. But there's two scenes where a character is talking straight to camera. One is an audition, and one you think is one but is not.
Yeah.
And it's up to you to – you'll figure out when you watch the movie. But again, it's like – it's so – I have – of all the creative outlets in the movie industry, I have the most sympathy for actors, because you're literally going in and getting rejected 100 times in a row. So I just thought that was interesting. Like, I obviously felt when with those scenes, you've been there, and that's why they were there. So what's it like on the other side of the table when you're kind of
– I was like, not cool. I was just like sitting on the couch, just being like, all right, do it again.
All empathy lost.
Taking all the power. No, it was – I was really impressed with how poised people were in those – and I learned a lot, actually, in terms of, like, if I were to ever audition again, which I don't think I will, but that I appreciated the actors who really went for it, even if they went in a totally wrong direction and did something weird and off base, than the people who were, like, holding back and not really committing. And I do have so much sympathy for actors, and I was so impressed with some of the people who came in and were able to be so present and, like, really in this crazy environment, just be like 100% what I would have wanted on set. And, like, some of those people didn't get cast because there was just, like, you know, so, but I like will never, like there was one woman who auditioned. I will like never forget that audition, and I hope to work with her because she was so good. And that was another thing where she was like, you might not get that part, but like the director will remember you if you do a good job.
That's great.
Yeah.
And I'm like telling people about her now, like other directors, because I thought she was so good. So,
so directing hasn't given you any itch to act again. You don't think that's...
Actually, on this this time I did. I on Always Shine, I was like, oh, I'm never going to act again. Directing's great. On this one, I was like, oh, I could act again.
Yeah.
You'll just never audition again.
Did you do the audition circuits here in Los Angeles?
Just a little bit. And I was just too nervous. I cared too much about wanting the part. I wonder if now, like, since I don't care, if I would be, like, so good in the room.
And would you cast yourself in one of the roles?
Yeah,
that's what I was
going to say. Could you direct yourself?
No, that's the one thing I would never do again. It's part of what's so fun about acting is losing yourself. And if you're directing, there's just no way to completely
lose
yourself.
Who's watching you, basically.
There's so much coming at you. Yeah. So many questions.
Yeah.
Well, very cool. Well, Sophia, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
You guys can find New Year, New You now on Hulu. Stay tuned for more cool stuff from her.
Yeah.
All right,
thanks, guys.
Thanks
so much.
Thanks, guys.